MiningWeb Weekly has got a devoted and growing audience, largely due to the wisdom and insights of Peter Major from Modern Corporate Solutions, our guru when it comes to mining, not just in South Africa, but worldwide. And I see over your shoulder, Pete, Mark Shuttleworth's, and that's where it ends. Finance Week. Wow. So we both got a little history with Finance Week. I was one of the early guys there.
My house is like a museum, Alec, especially with me.
Well, I hope you have boned up on gold, because its biggest decline in more than a decade, we are told in the headlines this morning, $300 an ounce has gone up so far. I suppose $300 has to be, if it drops $300, it has to be something out of the ordinary, but it's still about $4,000, both on the spot and the futures market.
Exactly, Alec. And this shows how hype runs the media, because since I was a little kid, I'm reading, the Dow just went up the largest number of points it's ever gone up. The Dow has fallen the largest number of points it's ever fallen. I've read that continually since as a kid. And yes, it's true, but what does it tell people? Tells them nothing. You want to deal in percentages, you know. Don't say, oh, gold's lost $300. It's never lost $300 in a day before. Well, yeah, because it's never been 4,380 before. But it's still a 3% drop is big, because we've seen gold running constantly for the whole year. And I don't think it did 3% in a day. Look, maybe it did, but a 3% move in a commodity price is a big move.
You're an athlete. You're an athlete. You can't keep improving your times indefinitely. When you run like heck, like gold's been doing, it's like that run up Table Mountain. And at some point, you got to take a breather, surely.
You're so right, Alec. Yes, 100% right. Yeah. Whatever commodity you're in, whatever you're doing, even if you're a company growing earnings, there's natural limitations. Call it gravity, call it the atmosphere. There's natural limitations on all these things. And so, yeah, commodity price, because it's relative. It's not on its own. You know, if you shot gold out of our atmosphere, there's no more gravity, there's no more air. Yes, it could go on forever, but it's not out of our atmosphere. It was approaching going there, but no, it's still here. It's subject to gravity. It's subject to relative. If people are buying gold at 4,000, where are they taking their money from? Do they really think gold at 4,000 is offering a safer, better rate of return than anything else? Well, somebody obviously didn't think anything else, because last week they started switching. They switched gold at 4380 into something else. Maybe it was Bitcoin. No, it wasn't Bitcoin, because we saw Bitcoin's taking a real tumble too. Was it property? Maybe it was cash. We've seen the dollar appreciate a little bit. We've seen bonds strengthen. We've seen cash strengthen. So, yeah, my intuition tells me somebody thinks cash right now and bonds are better hold than gold at 4,300.
I like the way you've put that. I remember for years and years, over a decade, I used to talk to David Shapiro every night on the radio. We had a 6 to 7 show. And poor old Dave had to come up with a reason why the market had moved in a particular direction. And he would scour his networks to find out why the price on the of barlows had gone 4% higher, and then come and tell us something sensible, when for the most part, I'm sure he'd admit, he was it was just somebody's idea and somebody's speculation. But the way you've explained it now is, when people sell one asset class, they're going into a different asset class. They're finding something that offers relatively better value.
Yeah, better value, more safety. Sometimes people are happier to forego a potential return just to get safety. You know, you're scared, you're tired, and just want safety. And yeah, you're not going to make much money in cash, but boy, you're not going to lose. You're not going to lose anything going in cash. And yeah, you're locking in a return, and you say, let's just go to home base for a bit, regroup, have a good sleep, eat, have a good powwow in the morning and say, do we want to continue with this investment that's been so amazing, but it's looking stretched? And you don't want to be the last guy out the door. You know, if someone screams fire in the theater and you smell smoke, you want to be one of the early guys out.
Mm-hmm. Is that part of the reason why we often have a rally in asset prices in the new year? People have gone away for Christmas, eaten a lot of turkey, slept better, and come back rejuvenated, refreshed, and perhaps with a different view on the world.
Alec, I've heard that for years, and I believe it. Yes. In this country, people take a solid month off for the Christmas holiday. But even in the Northern Hemisphere, they take a good week to 2 weeks off. And yeah, you regroup, and it's a new year. It's a convenient time to say, okay, whatever I lost, I'm cleaning off the table and I'm starting from scratch. You know, maybe I'm going to invest in what I lost in, but it's a clean slate. And without a doubt, I can't remember a January that was bad. You know, some Decembers didn't end well, but most of them do. And almost every January, February, they call it the New Year's effect. Yeah, people have second thoughts and they feel more confident. They've checked their resources, checked their overdraft. Where's all my investments at? And yeah, I'm fresh. I'm strong. I'm recharged. I'm ready for a tough year. Bring it on.
So would you be buying gold right now, or would you be just taking a few deep breaths, as you've suggested to us earlier, and watching from the sidelines?
I definitely watch from the sidelines. I thought everybody was happy with gold at 3,000 to 33. For 5 months, 6 months this year, it was almost flatlining. And I thought, wow, they built up a base here. But I didn't know it was a base for a spaceship to rocket launch, you know, to go to 4,300. I thought it was, okay, we'll accumulate. And I think most investors, we like gradual increases. We don't like sudden increases because it means something was unpredicted. And that's why it was sudden. And it can be unpredicted again and go back. But yeah, I'm too afraid it's gone too far out of any kind of mean, not just to itself, but relative to things like oil. You know, this oil-gold ratio, I'm going to have to relook at my graphs. I didn't see my 150-year graph, but the gold-oil ratio is the highest it's ever been, certainly for 50 years, I think. So that's it. People are saying, wow, I've got all this gold and I got oil next door. I think I'll buy oil at $60 and sell some gold at $4,300 because I know the world needs oil. Coal prices, you know, they're down to 82. And I know you want to talk about Conoco in a little bit. Well, gas prices are like coal and oil prices. They're pretty low right now. So, yeah, those are the extremes. Those three energies are about the lowest price commodities going right now. And gold was the highest price commodity by far.
So if you've stocked up and made a lot of money out of Harmony and Goldfields Limited and Anglo Gold, might not be a bad idea to switch some of those profits into Sasol.
I couldn't say it better.
Well, you can always say it better when we talk about rare earths, because this is a confusing area for most people. Maybe start from, well, let me give a little bit of background. It's a geopolitical hot potato at the moment. The Chinese have got a dominance in the supply and production, if you like, of rare earths. The Americans have discovered it's quite important for them to have rare earths. They're now doing a deal, have just done a deal this week with Australia. But just take us through the whole story here. What are rare earths, and why should all of this be so important to the White House, the U.S. strategy, and indeed, geopolitics?
Boy, I should have brushed up on my metallurgy or my mineralogy. But rare earths, they come combined together almost all the time. And I think there's 15 or 16 rare earths, and they got very strange, funny names on the periodic table. I think there's about 120 elements. They come together, though, and it turns out they're not really as rare as their name implies. But they're rare because they don't get used in very large volumes. They don't get mined in very many places. There's specific deposits of rare earths. We've got the most famous one, Steenkamp's Kraal. The rare earths there, they actually average 20-30% of the ore. You know, 20-30%, that's kind of like iron ore, right? Or manganese, chrome. That's how rich Steenkamp's Kraal is. It is so rich that if you're a virile young man and you work there more than a couple of days, you could leave there a bit sterile. So,
wow.
Very radioactive.
Explain that? Uh-huh. Okay.
Generally, there's a lot of thorium and there's uranium that comes with these rare earths. Now, those are specific rare earth deposits, but rare earth comes as a byproduct as well. So heavy mineral sands, you get ilmenite, rutile, zircon. You also get monazite. And monazite contains thorium, uranium, and some rare earths. And I've had two people arguing with me where the largest rare earth deposits are, Alec. One of them is in the Athabasca tar sands of Alberta. And we know that it's kind of that's a sassel on steroids. If you see that thing from a space shuttle, you could pick out what's going on. If you fly an airplane over it, you'll really see what's going on. It's mass environmental destruction. Because they have to dig up these tar sands in the permafrost and in the muck, and they have to boil it and bake it and squeeze out the oil. But in those tailings is unbelievable amounts of heavy mineral sands and rare earths. And there's large coal mines in America, in Wyoming, that they find they have rare earths and they don't have the nuclear component. They don't have very much thorium, uranium. And they're claiming they can supply all of the U.S. needs. So rare earths aren't really so rare, but because nobody paid attention to them, I don't know if China had the foresight or they just happened to have quite a few that were readily available, but they developed the means of separating them. And if you go to our large platinum producers and you see what it takes to separate those five PGMs, and they've got gold in there as well. Oh, and they've got base metals as well. It's quite a process separating platinum, palladium, rhodium, ruthenium, and iridium, and osmium. It's a real process. Well, extrapolate those six minerals that have to be separated. Now you've got 16 rare earths. And I won't get into the specifics. You know, some are better for cell phones, TV screens, video games. Some are particularly good for little electric motors and magnets like your rearview mirror, your side mirrors in your car, your electric seats. They're widely used in drones because drones have all these teeny little tiny motors and activation devices. And I read today, it was probably something you put out, that Ukraine is launching 7,000 drones a day. And that means Russia is launching at least that many. 7,000 times those little bits of rare earths. Well, now those rare are getting more rare because people need them. So America can find enough in its own country. It could find enough in its allies' country. But it's got to mine them. It's got to process them and take them to the extreme lengths that they are currently being used in the States. And that's going to take a few years. So it's always better late than never. And it's almost like a panic mode, though. When you see they run out and they buy 15% of Mountain Pass and they probably paid a high price for it. You know, why? Do you need that? You can just have a executive edict like World War II. And Mr. Trump could say, I hereby am confiscating all your rare earths. I'll pay you a certain rate. You know, do you need to go investing in them and own 15% just to get it? I think it's a patchwork of policy. But it's good they've woken up, and it's good that they're telling all the agencies that you have to deal with in America to get your mining license, hey, give this some national priority. Don't sit on this guy's mining application for 2 years and 3 years for his processing application. This is important. Please put somebody on it. I want an answer at the end of the week, maybe the end of today.
What about Australia? Australia.
They are the second largest producer, I believe, they have the fourth largest known resources, and they have very advanced mines and processing. So outside of China, Australia is a logical place to go. They mine the most and process the most after China. I think Brazil and India have larger resources. But Alec, once the word is out, we're paying for resources. You watch, America will go. Remember, they were nothing during the Arab oil embargo of 1974. And boy, after the Arabs cut off their oil, they went out and they proved a lot more oil and gas. They're the number one producer by far. They could probably do the same with rare earths. It's natural expediency. When uranium was big in the 1940s, early 50s, America was buying uranium from the Congo and from other far out places. They came to South Africa and they helped fund 31 uranium recovery plants. So we could easily get America on our side if we had a proactive politics in this country. We could say, gee, you guys financed 31 uranium plants on our gold mines in the 50s. How about helping us finance some rare earth extraction plants, Palabora, Zamkopstrif, Steenkampskroll, and we'll dedicate all our rare earths to you. Just help us fund the plants. You know, there's so much opportunity for us to work with America in this time of what crisis, you know, rare earth crisis.
Well, another story that we ran this morning on BizNews Premium is that the International Affairs Minister, Ronald Lamola, says that the Americans are the sticking point on our trade negotiations. They're using politics to stick there. Isn't it just a dream to get the politicians out the room, maybe get a few businessmen in there and say, come on, let's get jobs, let's create jobs, let's create wealth, let's play to South Africa's advantages. And rare earth seems to be one of them.
It is a dream, but it could be a lot more. I mean, to say America's the sticking point in our negotiations, is that news? Of course they're the sticking point. They're 10 times our size and they're kind of run by a bully. And we've been jerks for 30 years, giving them the middle finger and doing everything we could to piss them off. So that's not news. America is a stumbling block. Of course they are. So what are you going to do about it? That's the question. You know, maybe you got to bend a little bit. Maybe you got to give. And since when didn't politics affect international affairs? You know, is that news? Politics is international affairs. So get with the program, guys. We got 45% unemployment. We got no growth. And we got all the minerals that the world wants. Let's do something. And we got the two richest countries that would love to be friends with us. What a great position to be in. And we act like we're in a bad position. We're only in a bad position because we got the wrong bus driver. We got a busload of good people, a busload of great assets. And we got the same driver we've had for 35 years.
Just to correct that, they are 75 times our size and only 5 times our population. So that tells you something. 75 times the wealth and only, so they, which they splitting amongst, 5 times the number of people in this country. It kind of tells you that somebody's getting it right and somebody isn't. But that's moving on to another subject. Where's it going to go to, Pete? Where's rare earths going to end up, this debate between China, US, and non-compliance or integration with South Africa, which could be could use these to advantage?
My guess, Alec, is Mr. Trump is going to do what he needs to do to get China to release the rare earths that the US is currently dependent on. He's going to have to give Xi something that he wants. And he might do it behind the scenes, or Xi might want him to do it in front of everybody. But I think Mr. Trump will end up giving China what they want, because we have to have those earths. In the meantime, he will have Americans scrambling to start securing their own mine supply, their own concentrates, their own processing. And he's got a lot of help doing that. He's got the UK. They're very good on that kind of thing. He's got Germans. You know, Germans, we thought, were almost China's rival on rare earths up until around 2010, when we really found out the Germans were way behind China too. But you would think between the NATO countries, Canada is good at processing, other Asian countries, the Japanese are not dumb, the Koreans are not dumb, so, and the Australians are second to. So Mr. Trump has a lot of allies he can deal with, but yeah, it's going to take him a year or two. So he's going to have to pull his horns in negotiating with China because he doesn't want to be exposed and not have the rare earths that our military and our civilian uses require. But within 2 or 3 years, if he presses it hard enough, he shouldn't need China for any of them. But they do have a commanding lead, and they're not going to sit on their hands. You know, they are pushing their technology constantly. We talked about this, I think, last week on the ferrochrome and the ferromagnesium, manganese, that we've cut off so many of our toes, our fingers, our hands and feet. We'll never get any kind of dominance in the ferrochrome industry before. Even if we had the Eskom we did 20 years ago, even if we had the cheap electricity, the rest of our infrastructure is too messed up. We've lost markets, and China is just racing ahead, lowering their costs of production every day, every week, every month. So we don't run fast enough. We don't have the desire, the foresight to catch them. I doubt America will catch China even in 5 or 10 years on their rare earths, but they don't need to catch them. They just need to get up to speed that they can handle the production and the refinement to satisfy their needs.
Yeah. And the South Africans one day will look back and say, why are we listening to this person from many, many miles away based in Beijing? Well, it's because we didn't take advantage of the opportunity that sits with us right now. Moving on to another subject, copper. We had WoodMac bringing out a quite scary report about the future of copper, and they're a reputable organization. I would have thought so anyway. Pete, what was your thought on what they produced this week and the scenario that they're outlining for copper?
They're very reputable, Alec. They're very experienced, very professional. I don't think I can fault any of the data they've got in the whole report. It's massive. But at the end of the day, that guy down the street that drinks too much and sleeps under the lamppost, he's probably got the same percentage chance of guessing the copper price as the Woodward McKinsey report. And I've read those reports since I was IMCO Mining Machinery Marketing Manager back in the 80s. You know, our MD would come in, drop that report and say, Pete, look at this. There's going to be an explosion in copper demand. You better get yourself out to O'Keeppe and Messina and Prisca. And don't forget Palabora. You better get out there and start selling machines because there's going to be a copper explosion like we've never seen. Look at this Wood McKinsey report. That was in 85, 86. So the reality is, Alec, let's start at 2010. That's a nice round number. I think the world was using about 15, 16 million tons of copper in 2010. So we've grown from 16 million tons to 23 in 15 years. And I've been reading this scary report all these 15 years. And do you know what that growth rate is? Let's see. I want to be exact here. Huh? We don't want major guessing. And I wrote it down. Yeah, 2010, the world produced 16 million tons. We produced 23. That is growth of 2.62%. Now, most people earn that on cash in real terms, right? After inflation, you know, a real rate. I think that's what the real South African bond, you know, we got a dollar linked or real interest rate bond. I think it trades at 2.5-3%. So that's good. Keeps you above inflation, but that's the growth rate of copper. And this has been unprecedented growth, you know, since Thomas Edison invented electricity or the way to transmit it, the way to generate and transmit it. So yeah, copper growth, mine production has been averaging 2.62. Now maybe offtake is growing 3% because I haven't put in recycling. And we know recycling is big at these prices. You know, people are tearing your own house apart while you're living in it to get any copper you've got. But we know the world likes copper. We know it's usable. We've known that for 150 years. And if the price goes from $4.85, which is $10,800 a ton, if the price goes to $11,000, $12,000, $13,000 a ton, we'll probably produce more. And the price has been there before. I always refer to the long-term average price. I don't know what it is offhand. I think it's maybe around 6,500, 7,000. So we're trading above the long-term average price here already, but it's been much higher. You know, it's been 14, 15,000 in real terms. So that tells me there's not a panic out there. Not like gold is trading at multiples of its long-term average. It's trading two standard deviations out of its long-term average. I think people are promoting this. A lot of it's wishful thinking. You know, we all want our projects to be approved. We want them to be funded. So we keep running around telling people there's going to be a copper crunch. You better get in and fund my copper project. You better invest in my copper project or you're going to be caught short. But investors are wiser than that. They've heard the stories. Am I bullish on copper? Yeah, it has done better than base metals such as aluminum, better than zinc, better than lead, which has been the deadest base metal of all. It's just stuck at 2,000 a ton. But remember, platinum was stuck at 1,000 an ounce for 8 or 9 years. It hardly moved for the last 8 or 9 years around 1,000 an ounce. Then it just shot up to 1,600 the last 2 months. So I don't think copper is going to do that. It's slowly been working its way up the last few years. The demand is there, but the world's not going crazy for it, or the price would be crazy.
Thank you for that context. When you mentioned copper, we do have Orion in our portfolio. Is there an update that you can give us on this remaining fairly speculative but good long-term investment?
Nothing earth-shattering, Alec, but we've got a good, experienced general manager running Orion now. The CEO, Tony Lennox, has spent years at Palabora, which was not an easy copper mine. You know, it was an open pit converted to a block cave underground. So he should be able to handle Prieska and O'Keep in his sleep. Their problem is, to do it properly, they need a lot of money. They need $350, $400 million. The shaft is there. The headframe's there. The levels going down to it are there. And $400 million in mining projects, it's an average size. It's even below average, you know. Most mining projects are a billion plus. But in South Africa, oh my gosh, $350 to $400 million for arguably a new mine, it's terrifying for foreign investors. It shows how tricky it is. So Orion's worked very hard at finding funders. So they've got streaming contracts for byproducts. They've got forward sales on the existing offtake. We've seen in the paper and the news release, they've got a big, big buyer named Glencore, who's really interested, who's claiming they're happy to fund more than half the cost of getting the big mine going. And those negotiations are at a pretty serious stage now. So I think that's good news, that there's many parties knocking on their door. We know there's Chinese companies been knocking on their door for a long time. The Australians and the Chinese, they're worried about having too many eggs in the basket. So I think Orion is keen to deal with someone that's been in South Africa for quite a while. Maybe you call it the devil you know, then instead of the devil you don't know. But their problem is not that bad. Their problem now is they have too many copper ore bodies to decide which one will give us the fastest, easiest payback. And they probably have too many suitors right now, you know, various companies that want to fund it. They still need, I think, a good equity partner. They kind of have the IDC, but it would be nice if they had a mining company in there, experienced mining company that had a strong balance sheet. And I believe they are negotiating with a couple at this time. So, you know, none of this is classified news. Anybody who's been reading the paper or the news releases knows this, but we are near the end of the year. And Tony says, I am going to be producing copper by the end of 2026. So he doesn't want to be a liar. He doesn't want to embarrass himself or the company. It's going to be a little bit tight now, but they can mine copper literally in 30 days from now. The question is, can they mill it? Because you can't build a plant in less than 12 months. So I think the pressure's on them to make that announcement. We're going to start mining in this location and we're going to mill it to a concentrate. So I think there's going to be an announcement here definitely before December.
So just hang in there. and watch.
Yeah.
Watch the news wires.
It's a great asset, and lots of people are looking strongly at it. It's got to be the safest, most well-known mining asset in South Africa right now, in my mind.
No. And those mining operations in China. It was interesting for me to read that the Chinese government, well, I don't know what they call themselves, the Central Committee of the Communist Party, they are now sending out signals to the coal mines, especially those who are not perceived to be safe, that they're killing too many people, or too many people are dying in the process of producing coal, because they need the coal, and they seem to be also building up their stocks of other commodities like iron ore, etc. What's going on there, Pete, in China, in coal, and indeed on these the stock building processes?
I'm arguably one of the worst people to talk because I haven't been there and I don't follow it very closely. But I do know, on an accident viewpoint, China's been, they've been the largest mining accident country by far because they're the biggest mining country by far. They mine half the world's coal, which is it 3 billion tons? The world consumes 6 and China... It's either 6 or 8. I can't believe I don't remember, but they mine 50% of the world's coal, just about like iron ore, close to 50%. So when you're mining billions of tons of coal, you've got more men on the mine than the rest of the world put together. So naturally, you're going to have more accidents. They have made huge strides in their accidents. They were killing over 3,500 people a year as late as 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Now, officially, they've brought that down to under 300 people a year in just their coal mines. You know, it's 260, 280. And we can say, yeah, one death too many. Yes, one death is too many. And it doesn't matter if that death is on the highway or coming out of a restaurant or in your home. One death is one death too many. But they have made huge strides to bring yearly deaths from 3,500 down to 350, and increase production at the same time. Now, I've seen people say those aren't reliable statistics because there's so many small producers. And that's probably true. That's true in this country too. We used to have most of our coal mines under the hands of 4 or 5 large producers. We had very accurate statistics. These were listed companies. They were under the magnifying glass from 100 analysts. We don't have that in this country now. I think arguably half our coal, we barely know where it comes from, has no oversight. We know how many, we have an idea how many people we're losing on the gold mines unofficially. You know, 100, 200, you know, these Zama Zama deaths, they don't get recorded. Is it because they're not classified as humans, or is it because we say, oh, they're foreigners? Or do we say, well, they're not part of the Chamber of Mines? So we can't point a finger at anyone for dubious official statistics because a lot of our industry is off the radar screen. We know China's improving. I don't know what the accident rate on those mines is now, other than it's a lot better than it was 5 years ago, which was tremendously better than 10, 15, 20 years ago. And it's interesting, Alec, if I can make an analogy. Remember, everybody were plotting the COVID curves when China had COVID and then we had it and then America. It turns out after all that 4 years of COVID, every country had the same curve. It didn't matter if you were Sweden and you told people, go out to a restaurant, do what you want, we'll take it as it comes. Or if you were Chinese and you were welding people's doors shut, if you even thought there was COVID, in the end, everybody had to follow that same curve. Well, because that's natural. You know, you can't choose where COVID's going to hit and where it's not going to hit. That's how the accident rate is on mines. Yes, we killed a lot of people on our underground mines. We killed 1,000 a year for decades. America killed more than 1,000 a year for decades. England, Germany, Poland killed a few thousand a year for decades. But we all have followed this curve down to where we've got it down to one man per million tons or something like that. And it's getting harder to make big improvements because you're moving millions and billions of tons. You have very few people down there, but you're always going to have some kind of accident. You analyze those accidents and say, was it the individual's fault? Was it an act of God? Was it the company's fault? We know China can still improve a lot. We look at the way they run copper mines in Zambia compared to First Quantum. And you've got the Indians in Zambia. So there you have three comparisons you can make. And we all know it is a quantum difference between the Chinese and the Indian producers in Zambia and the American Canadian producers. So they've got a ways to go.
Mm-hmm.
Safety and environmental and accounting and accuracy of production and good housekeeping. I think all these African countries must have big regrets, if they have any brain and memory, must have big regrets of how they treated the companies that they had here and look at the companies that have come in their place. You know, big, big difference. Just looking at how the Anglo-American group of companies and the American companies, Newmont and Phelps Dodge, how they were running operations in Africa in the 60s and 70s and how, unfortunately, a lot of the Chinese and Indian companies are in there now running.
Mm. Well, let's hope that there are people in their portals of power who are doing those numbers. Just to close off with, Kinetico, it is a stock that we're watching. It should be doing better. It seems to be bouncing all over the place. Any update there?
I don't have an update, but they're doing the right thing at the right time in the right country. They're in South Africa, and we need a natural gas producer. You know, Sasol's natural gas that comes from coal is more expensive, is dirtier, and is limited. And we've seen the Mozambican fields and our fields off George, you know, running out. And this company claims they've got gas inland, that we have gas in our ground. And I'm not sure what the legislation is, because remember when we first found we had shale oil, the ANC stopped any kind of exploration, and they called it strategic, and they passed quite punitive regulations. Between 25 and 50% of your deposit had to go to government, and they had even more extreme regulations than for mining deposits, which I thought was crazy because you didn't even have any exploration going on, and you're already penalizing people. Therefore, you chased everybody out of the country. Now, Kinetico, they claim they've got the deposits. I haven't looked at them close enough, and I'm going to after this talk, because natural gas prices are very low now, as are coal prices. And that stock, by having a unique commodity that we're in short supply of in this country, and I think natural gas is going to go up. I think oil prices are too low. Coal prices, I think, could go up a bit. Definitely natural gas can go up. You know, it's just cleaner, easier to transport, more ESG. And they're well capitalized. You know, this isn't a rinky-dink $10 or $15 million market cap company like we're used to seeing in the small cap sector. They've got I think it's 110 Aussie, which is still $75, $80 million US. I don't have an update, Alec, but I will next week.
Peter Major is with Modern Corporate Solutions. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.